Anthropocentricity. Satyajit Das, expert, derivatives and risk, author, Extreme Money. Parallax describes the apparent change in direction of a moving object caused by alteration in the observer's position. In the graphic work of M.C. Escher, human faculties are similarly deceived and an impossible reality made plausible. While not strictly a scientific theorem, anthropocentrism, the assessment of reality through an exclusively human perspective, is deeply embedded in science and culture. Improving knowledge requires abandoning anthropocentricity, or at least acknowledging its existence. Anthropocentrism's limits derive from the physical constraints of human cognition and specific psychological attitudes. Being human entails specific faculties, intrinsic attitudes, and values and belief systems that shape inquiry and understanding. The human mind has evolved a specific physical structure and biochemistry that shapes our thought processes. The human cognitive system determines our reasoning and therefore our knowledge. Language, logic, mathematics, abstract thought, cultural beliefs, history, and memories create a specific human frame of reference, which may restrict what we can know or understand. There may be other forms of life and intelligence. The ocean has revealed creatures that live from chemosynthesis in ecosystems around deep-sea hydrothermal vents without access to sunlight. Life forms based on materials other than carbon may also be feasible. An entirely radical set of cognitive frameworks and alternative knowledge cannot be discounted. Like a train that can run only on tracks, which determine its direction and destination, human knowledge may ultimately be constrained by what evolution has made us. Knowledge was originally driven by the need to master the natural environment to meet basic biological needs, survival and genetic propagation, and to deal with the unknown and forces beyond human control. Superstition, religion, science, and other belief systems evolved to meet these human needs. In the 18th century, medieval systems of aristocratic and religious authority were supplanted by a new model of scientific method, rational discourse, personal liberty, and individual responsibility. But this didn't change the basic underlying drivers. Knowledge is also influenced by human factors: fear, greed, ambition, submission, tribal collusion, altruism, and jealousy, as well as complex power relationships and interpersonal group dynamics. Behavioral science illustrates the inherent biases in human thought. Understanding operates within these biological and attitudinal constraints. As Friedrich Nietzsche wrote, "Every philosophy also hides a philosophy. Every opinion is also a hiding place. Every word is also a mask." Understanding of fundamental issues remains limited. The cosmological nature and origins of the universe are contested. The physical source and nature of matter and energy are debated. The origins and evolution of biological life remain unresolved. Resistance to new ideas frequently restricts the development of knowledge. The history of science is a succession of controversies: a non-geocentric universe, continental drift, the theory of evolution, quantum mechanics, climate change. Science, paradoxically, seems also to have inbuilt limits. Like an endless set of Russian dolls, quantum physics is an endless succession of seemingly infinitely divisible particles. Werner Heisenberg's uncertainty principle posits that human knowledge about the world is always incomplete, uncertain, and highly contingent. Kurt Gödel's incompleteness theorems of mathematical logic establish inherent limitations of all but the most trivial axiomatic systems of arithmetic. Experimental methodology and testing is flawed. Model predictions are often unsatisfactory. As Nassim Nicholas Taleb has observed, "You can disguise charlatanism under the weight of equations and nobody can catch you, since there is no such thing as a controlled experiment." Challenging anthropocentrism doesn't mean abandoning science or rational thought. It doesn't mean reversion to primitive religious dogma, messianic phantasms, or obscure mysticism. Transcending anthropocentricity may allow new frames of reference, expanding the boundary of human knowledge. It may allow human beings to think more clearly and consider different perspectives. It may encourage possibilities outside the normal range of experience and thought. It may also allow a greater understanding of our existential place within nature and in the order of things. As William Shakespeare's Hamlet cautioned a friend, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, that are dreamt of in your philosophy." But fundamental biology may not allow the required change of reference framework. While periodically humbled by the universe, human beings remain enamored, for the most part, of the notion that they are the apogee of development. But as Mark Twain observed in Letters from the Earth, "He took pride in man. Man was his finest invention. Man was his pet, after the housefly." Writing in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the late English author Douglas Adams speculated that Earth was a powerful computer and human beings were its biological components, designed by hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings to answer the ultimate questions about the universe and life. To date, science has not produced a conclusive refutation of this whimsical proposition. Whether or not we can go beyond anthropocentrism, it's a reminder of our limits. As Martin Rees, Emeritus Professor of Cosmology and Astrophysics at Cambridge, has noted, "Most educated people are aware that we are the outcome of nearly 4 billion years of Darwinian selection, but may tend to think that humans are somehow the culmination. Our sun, however, is less than halfway through its lifespan. It will not be humans who watch the sun's demise 6 billion years from now. Any creatures that then exist will be as different from us as we are from bacteria or amoebae." Truer perceptions are fitter perceptions. Donald D. Hoffman, cognitive scientist, University of California, Irvine, author, Visual Intelligence. Those of our predecessors who perceived the world more accurately enjoyed a competitive advantage over their less fortunate peers. They were thus more likely to raise children and become our ancestors. We're the offspring of those who perceived more truly, and we can be confident that our perceptions are, in the normal sense, reasonably accurate. There are, of course, endogenous limits. We can, for instance, perceive light only in a narrow window of wavelengths between roughly 400 and 700 nanometers, and sound only in a narrow window of frequencies between 20 and 20,000 hertz. Moreover, we're prone on occasion to have perceptual illusions. But with those provisos noted, it's fair to conclude on evolutionary grounds that our perceptions are in general reliable guides to reality. This is the consensus of researchers studying perception via brain imaging, computational modeling, and psychophysical experiments. It's mentioned in passing in many professional publications and stated as fact in standard textbooks. But it gets evolution wrong. Fitness and truth are distinct concepts in evolutionary theory. To specify a fitness function, you must specify not just the state of the world, but also, inter alia, a particular organism, a particular state of that organism, and a particular action. Dark chocolates can kill cats, but are a fitting gift from a suitor on Valentine's Day. Monte Carlo simulations using evolutionary game theory, with a wide range of fitness functions and of randomly created environments, find that truer perceptions are routinely driven to extinction by perceptions tuned to the relevant fitness functions. The extension of these simulations to evolutionary graphs is in progress, and the same result is expected. Simulations with genetic algorithms find that truth never gets on stage to have a chance to go extinct. Perceptions tuned to fitness are typically far less complex than those tuned to truth. They require less time and resources to compute and are thus advantageous in environments where swift action is critical. But even apart from considerations of time and complexity, true perceptions go extinct simply because natural selection selects for fitness, not truth. We must take our perceptions seriously. They've been shaped by natural selection to guide adaptive behaviors and keep us alive long enough to reproduce. We should avoid cliffs and snakes, but we mustn't take our perceptions literally. They aren't the truth. They're simply a species-specific guide to behavior. Observation is the empirical foundation of science. The predicates of this foundation, including space, time, physical objects, and causality, are a species-specific adaptation, not an insight. Thus, this view of perception has implications for fields beyond perceptual science, including physics, neuroscience, and the philosophy of science. The old assumption that fitter perceptions are truer perceptions is deeply woven into our concept of science. The funeral of this assumption won't be snubbed with a back-page obituary, but heralded with regime change. The intrinsic beauty and elegance of mathematics allows it to describe nature. Gregory Benford, Emeritus Professor of Physics and Astronomy, University of California, Irvine, science fiction author, Shipstar. Many believe this seeming axiom, that beauty leads to descriptive power. Our experience seems to show this, mostly from the successes of physics. There's some truth to it, but also some illusion. There's a ready explanation for how a long-ago primate acquired the beginnings of a mathematical appreciation of nature. Hunting, that primate found it easier to fling rocks or spears at fleeing prey than to chase them down. Some of his fellows found the curve of a flung stone difficult to achieve, but he didn't. He found the parabola beautiful and simpler to achieve because that pleasurable sensation provided evolutionary feedback. Over eons, this led to an animal that invented complex geometries, calculus, and beyond. This is a huge leap, of course, an evolutionary overshoot. We seem to be smarter than needed simply to survive in the natural world. Earlier hominids did, even spreading over most of the planet. We did go through some population bottlenecks in our past, perhaps as recently as 130,000 years ago. Those eras of intense selection may explain why we have such vastly disproportionate mental abilities. Still, there remain, beyond evolutionary arguments, two mysteries in math. Whence its amazing ability to describe nature, and why its intrinsic beauty and elegance. Parabolas are elegant, true. They describe how hard bodies fly through the air under gravity. But the motion of a falling leaf demands several differential equations, taking into account wind velocity, gravity, the leaf's geometry, fluid flow, and much else. A cruising airplane is even harder to describe. Neither case is elegant or simple. So the utility of math stands separate from its intrinsic beauty. Mathematics is most elegant when we simplify the system considered. With a baseball, we account for the initial acceleration and angle, the air and gravity, and out comes a parabola as a good approximation. Not so with the leaf. And that parabola? We see its simple beauty far too slowly for it to be of any use in real time. Our appreciation comes afterward. To actually make a parabola work for us in baseball, we learn how to throw. Such learning builds on hard-wired neuronal networks in the brain, selected for over evolutionary times, since knowing how to throw a missile is adaptive. A human pitcher can more subtly affect the trajectory by throwing curves, knuckleballs, and so on. Those are more complex trajectories, probably less elegant, but still well within the capability of our nervous system. But for well-learned actions, all that processing goes on at unconscious levels. In fact, Too much conscious attention to the details of action can interfere. Athletes know this. It's the art of staying in the zone. Probably that zone is where the mind runs on its sense of rightness, beauty, economy of effort. Further, elegance is hard to define, as are most aesthetic judgments. Richard Feynman once noted that it's simple to make known laws more elegant, say by starting with Newton's force law, F equals ma, then defining R equals F minus ma. The equation R equals zero is visually more elegant but contains no more information. The Lagrangian method in dynamics is elegant. Just write the expression for kinetic energy minus the potential energy, but one must know a fundamental theory to do so. The elegance of the Lagrangian comes later, as a mathematical aid. More recently, it's hard to devise an elegant cosmology theory that yields directly the small cosmological constant we observe. Some solve this problem by invoking the anthropic principle, and thus multiverses of some sort. But this ventures near a violation of another form of the elegant standard, Occam's razor. Imagining a vast sea of multiverses, with us arising in one where conditions produce intelligent beings, seems excessive to many of us. It invokes a plentitude we can never see. The scientific test of multiverse cosmology is whether it leads to predictable consequences. Can multiverses converse with one another? That would be a way of verifying the basis of such theories. Most multiverse models say there's no possible communication between the infinitude of multiverses. Brain theory, though, comes from models where no force law operates between brains except gravitation. Perhaps someday an instrument like LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, can detect such waves from brains. But is it elegant to shift confirmation onto some far future technology? Sweeping dust under a rug seems inelegant to me. Evolution doesn't care about beauty and elegance, just utility. Beauty does play a secondary role, though. The male who best throws the spear to bring down prey is appreciated and may have a choice of many mates. It just so happens that the effective and now beautiful act of spear throwing is describable with fairly simple math. We make the short step to say the underlying math is also beautiful. Math's utility implies that for a suitably simple model of the universe, there should be a fairly simple mathematical theory of everything, something like general relativity, describable by a one-line equation. Searching for it on that intuitive basis may lead us to such a theory. I suspect that a model capturing the full complexity of the universe, though, would take up a lot more than one line. When we say a math model is elegant and beautiful, we express the limits of our own minds. It's not a deep description of the world. In the end, simple models are much easier to comprehend than complex ones. We cannot expect that the path of elegance will always guarantee that we're on the right track. Geometry. Carlo Rovelli, theoretical physicist, professeur de classe exceptionnelle, Université de la Méditerranée, Marseille. Author, The First Scientist, Anaximander and His Legacy. We will continue to use geometry as a useful branch of mathematics, but it's time to abandon the long-standing idea of geometry as the description of physical space. The idea that geometry is the description of physical space is ingrained in us and might seem hard to get rid of, but getting rid of it is unavoidable and just a matter of time. Might as well get rid of it soon. Geometry developed at first as a description of the properties of parcels of agricultural land. In the hands of the ancient Greeks, it became a powerful tool for dealing with abstract triangles, lines, circles, and the like, and it was applied to describe paths of light and movements of celestial bodies with great efficacy. In the modern age, with Newton, it became the mathematics of physical space. This geometrization of physical space appeared to be further vindicated by Einstein, who described space, actually space-time, in terms of the curved geometry of Riemann. But in fact, this was the beginning of the end. Einstein discovered that the Newtonian space described by geometry is in fact a field, like the electromagnetic field, and fields are nicely continuous and smooth only if measured at large scales. In reality, they're quantum entities that are discrete and fluctuating. Therefore, the physical space in which we're immersed is in reality a quantum dynamical entity that has very little in common with what we call geometry. It's a pullulating process of finite interacting quanta. We can still use expressions like quantum geometry to describe it, but the reality is that a quantum geometry is not much of a geometry anymore. Better to rid ourselves of the idea that our spatial intuition is always reliable. The world is far more complicated and beautiful than a geometrical space and things moving in it. Calculus. Andrew Lee, Associate Professor, School of Communications, American University. Author, The Wikipedia Revolution. I do not propose that we should do away with the study of change or the area under the curve, or bury Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz. However, for decades now, learning calculus has been the passing requirement for entry into modern fields of study by combining the rigorous requirements of science, technology, engineering, and math. Universities still require undergraduates to take anywhere from 1 to 3 semesters of calculus as a pure math discipline, typically featuring complex math concepts uncontextualized and removed from practical applications, and heavily emphasizing proofs and theorems. Calculus has thus become a hazing ritual for those interested in going into one of the most essential fields today, computer science. Calculus has very little relevance to the day-to-day work of coders, hackers, and entrepreneurs, yet poses a significant barrier to recruiting sorely needed candidates for today's digital workforce. This problem is particularly urgent in the area of programming and coding. Undergraduate computer science programs are starting to bounce back from a dearth of enrollment that plagued them in the early internet era, but we could do a lot more to fill the ranks if we rid ourselves of the lingering view that computer science is an extension of mathematics, a view that dates from an era when computers were primarily crafted as the ultimate calculators. Calculus remains in many curricula more as a rite of passage than for any particular need. It's one way of problem solving, and it contributes to our ability to absorb more complex concepts, but retaining it as an obstacle course that one must navigate in order to program and code is counterproductive. Leaving in this obtuse math requirement is lazy curricular thinking. It sticks with a model that weeds out people for no reason related to their ability to program. This leads us to the question, what makes for good programmers? The answer is an ability to deconstruct complex problems into a series of smaller, doable ones, to think procedurally about systems and structures, to manipulate bits and do amazing things with them. If calculus isn't a good fit for these pursuits, what should replace it? Discrete math, combinatorics, computability, and graph theory are far more important than calculus. These are all standard and immensely necessary fields in most modern computer science programs, but they typically come after the calculus requirement gauntlet. People are finding other formal and peer learning methods to pick up coding outside the higher education environment: meetups, codeathons, online courses, video tutorials. Dropping the calculus requirement would bring these folks into the fold earlier and more methodically. This won't mean we'll be turning universities into trade schools. We still want our research scientists in training and our PhD candidates in STEM to know and master calculus, linear algebra, and differential equations. But for too long, calculus has served as a choke point for training digital-savvy, self-starting innovators. Clemson University experimented with moving calculus farther down the curriculum, not as a prerequisite, but as a class in sync with the need for it in other STEM classes. A 2004 longitudinal study showed a statistically significant improvement in retention in engineering when it reconfigured its approach to introduce math in later semesters. We need more of these experiments and further radical curricular thinking to get past the prerequisite model that has dominated the field for decades. How can so many people be interested in coding and programming yet not be served by our top institutions of higher learning? By treating computer science largely as a STEM discipline instead of as a whole new capability cutting across several fields, we haven't evolved with the times. The sooner we move beyond STEM-oriented thinking, the better. Computer Science. Neil Gershenfeld, physicist, director, Center for Bits and Atoms, MIT. Author, FAB, The Coming Revolution on Your Desktop. Computer science is a curious sort of science, one that implicitly ignores and even explicitly opposes the principles of the rest of science. There are many models of computation, imperative versus declarative versus functional languages, SISD versus SIMD versus MIMD architectures, scalar versus vector versus multi-core processors, RISC versus CISC versus VLIW instruction sets. But there is only one underlying physical reality. A patch of space can contain states which can interact and take time to transit. Anything else is a fiction. Heroic efforts are now going into maintaining that fiction. Programming today is a bit like inhabiting the pleasure gardens in Fritz Lang's Metropolis, confident that the workers in the machine rooms down below will follow your instructions. Interconnect bottlenecks, cache misses, thread concurrency, data center power budgets, and the inefficiency of parallel processors and programmers are rumblings of discontent from the underground. Software doesn't have physical units like time and space, but the hardware that executes it does. The code for an application program, the executable code that it's compiled to, and the circuits that run it don't look at all like each other. When a map is zoomed, there's also a hierarchical structure from city to state to country, but the geometry of the representation isn't changed. Why do we do that for software? I blame two people for this state of affairs, Alan Turing and John von Neumann. They're famous for what were essentially historically important hacks. Turing was interested in the question of what was computable. His namesake machine was meant to be a theoretical model, not an experimental prescription. It had a head that read and wrote symbols stored on a tape. While that might sound straightforward, it's an unphysical distinction. Persistence and interaction are both properties of a physical state. This segregation of function was elaborated in the organs of von Neumann's architecture. Even though that underpins almost every computer made today, it wasn't intended to be a universal truth. Rather, it was articulated in an influential report that von Neumann wrote on programming within the limited confines of an early computer, the EDVAC. Turing and von Neumann understood the limits of their models. Late in life, they both studied computing in spatial structures, pattern formation for Turing, self-replication for von Neumann. But their legacy lives on in the instruction pointer in almost any processor, the modern descendant of Turing's head reading a tape. All the other instructions not pointed to consume information processing resources, but don't process information. In nature, everything happens everywhere all the time. While an industry has developed devices for computation, a much smaller community has studied the physics of computation. Outside of what is traditionally considered to be computer science, they have developed quantum computers that use entanglement and superposition, microfluidic logic that transports material as well as information, analog logic that solves digital problems with continuing device degrees of freedom, and digital fabrication to code construction of programmable materials. Most important, programming models are emerging that represent and respect physical resources rather than viewing them as a can to be kicked to someone else to worry about. This is turning out to be easier than harder to do because it avoids all the issues of converting from an unphysical to a physical world. In the movie The Matrix, Neo is given a choice between a red pill to exit the fictional world he's been inhabiting or a blue pill to maintain the illusion. What he found when he got out was much messier, but ultimately much more satisfying. There's a similar choice now before the digital world, between avoiding or embracing the physical reality it inhabits. Think of Turing's machine and von Neumann's architecture as technological training wheels. They've given us a good ride, but something of a do-over is now needed. To introduce physical units into software in order to be able to program the ultimate universal computer, the universe. Science advances by funerals. Samuel Barondes, Jean and Sanford Robertson Chair in Neurobiology and Psychiatry, University of California, San Francisco. Author, Making Sense of People. When Max Planck began studying physics at the University of Munich in 1874, his teacher, Philipp von Joly, warned him that it was already a mature field with little more to learn. This attitude was widely held through the end of the 19th century. In 1900, Lord Kelvin, the great British physicist, put it clearly, "There is nothing new to be discovered in physics now. All that remains is more and more precise measurement." In Planck's early career, he had no reason to doubt this complacent position. And yet, in the same year that Kelvin made his pronouncement, Planck found himself disproving it. He had been working on the relationship of heat to light, a topic of great interest to the emerging electric companies, and he had proposed an equation consistent with classical physical concepts. But he was dismayed to learn of new experimental results that proved him wrong. With his back against the wall, the 42-year-old Planck quickly thought up an alternative equation that fit the data. But the new equation also had a disruptive effect. Hard to reconcile with traditional ideas, it turned out to be an initial building block for a completely new view of physics called quantum theory. The resistance to this disruption by conservative members of the physics community may be taken as one example of Planck's petulant claim that a new scientific truth will not triumph until its opponents eventually die. But the triumph of quantum theory didn't really depend on this grim prospect. Members of the physics establishment soon began to take quantum theory seriously, because it wasn't just a weird idea that had popped into Planck's head. It had become necessary because of a surprising experimental result. This is how science usually works. When experiments challenge a prevailing idea, attention is paid. If the experiments are confirmed, the old idea is modified. In fields in which decisive experimentation is relatively easy, such change may happen quickly and is certainly not dependent on the death of its senior practitioners. Only in fields that don't lend themselves to decisive experimentation is it hard to definitively challenge a prevailing position. In such fields, even death may not be enough, and the tenuous positions may survive for generations. So, Planck got it wrong. The development of new scientific truths doesn't depend on the passing of stubborn conservative opponents. It is, instead, mainly dependent on the continuous enrollment of talented newcomers eager to make their mark by changing the existing order. In Planck's case, it was the arrival of the young Albert Einstein, rather than the demise of his senior opponents, that propelled quantum theory forward. As Douglas Stone showed in Einstein and the Quantum, it was the 25-year-old patent clerk, a fledgling outsider with nothing to lose, who became the driving force in the development of this theory. As for his elders, Einstein couldn't have cared less. Planck's Cynical View of Scientific Change. Hugo Mercier, Cognitive Scientist, Ambizione Fellow, Cognitive Science Center, University of Neuchâtel. This year's Edge question was inspired by Max Planck's bleak view of scientific change. A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it. Certainly, Planck's assessment struck a chord with the general public. Its reception among the more educated public was likely eased when Thomas Kuhn pointed out that well-established scientists would have an incentive to resist novel theories instead of jettisoning their life work. If even scientists, with their freedom of discourse and exacting standards of evidence, cannot change their minds when they should, what hope is there for the rest of us? Why bother trying to convince anyone ever? Fortunately, Planck was wrong. Detailed accounts of major scientific changes reveal time after time how quickly scientists adopt novel theories, provided they're well supported. One can hardly blame, for instance, 16th-century scholars for rejecting Copernicus's heliocentric model. It didn't account for the data much better than the alternatives. It was laden with inelegant post-hoc fixes, and it had no answer to such basic questions as, if the Earth is moving, then why can't we feel it? As these issues got resolved, Kepler introduced elliptical orbits, Galileo understood the principles of motion, the heliocentric model promptly gained supporters. Other theories that also required dramatic conceptual change were much more quickly accepted as they rested from the start on better arguments. When Newton first advanced a new theory of light, one that upset centuries-old beliefs, he did so in a short article that offered little experimental evidence for many of his claims. Yet the cogency of his theory proved persuasive to many. This was not a case of argument from authority, since Newton had very little at the time. When, 30 years later, Newton published his Optics, with a much better presentation of the same theory and a plethora of well-described experiments, he took natural philosophers by storm. A few years and a few replications later, most were sold on his ideas. By taking his belief in the existence of phlogiston to the grave, Joseph Priestley became a favorite example of the pig-headedness of even brilliant scientists. But Priestley was very much an exception. When Lavoisier started publicizing his discoveries and criticizing the concept of phlogiston, he was met with resistance, but also with acceptance. Resistance to new theories that were half-baked, even in Lavoisier's own mind, acceptance for his solid methods and results. Once the French chemist formulated a theory that could properly account for the main phenomena of interest, it was accepted in a matter of years. Examples multiply. The heart of Darwin's ideas was adopted by his colleagues shortly after publication of The Origin. Plate tectonics went from speculation to textbook example in a dozen years, both showing that when the arguments are good, the vast majority of scientists change their minds accordingly. As science historian Bernard Cohen has noted, even Planck, whose ideas were no less revolutionary than the examples mentioned here, managed to convince most of his peers, not only the new generation. Evidently, not every science reaches a consensus equally quickly. Political scientists, say, do not have the benefit of data quite as precise as that gathered by particle physicists. Still, it's important to give science as a whole its due, not only because such efficient belief change is no mean feat, but also because a pessimistic, cynical view of the power of argumentation can have pernicious effects. If people who disagree with us are never going to change their minds, then why even talk to them? If we don't engage in discussion with people who disagree with us, we'll never learn of the, often perfectly good, reasons they disagree with us. If we cannot address those reasons, our arguments are likely to prove unconvincing. Our failures to convince will only reinforce the belief that we face pig-headedness rather than rational disagreement. A belief in the inefficiency of argumentation can be a destructive, self-fulfilling prophecy. We should give scientists and argumentation generally more credit. Let's retire Planck's cynical view of scientific change. New ideas triumph by replacing old ones. Jared Diamond, professor of geography, University of California, Los Angeles, author, The World Until Yesterday. The history of science is much more variegated than assumed in the Edge question about the abandonment and burial of old ideas. While the view that new ideas triumph by replacing old ones fits some scientific developments, in many other cases, new ideas take over a vacuum formerly occupied by no well-articulated idea at all. That happens for either of two reasons. New ideas responding to new information made possible by new measurements, or else responding to new outlooks. Among historians of science, the term used rather than the inadequate English term outlook is the German Fragestellung, literally the posing of a question, but more broadly meaning a worldview from which that question can arise. I'll give two or three examples illustrating each of those two reasons. The most familiar modern example of a new idea made possible by new measurements is Watson and Crick's double helix model of the structure of DNA. Their model didn't replace a previous established model whose opponents gradually died out without abandoning their error. Instead, the Watson-Crick model was made possible by two recent sets of measurements, analyses of the chemical composition of DNA, revealing equivalent amounts of the bases adenine and thymine, and of cytosine and guanine, and X-ray crystallographic evidence. As is well known, two models of DNA structure were then proposed nearly simultaneously, by Pauling and by Watson and Crick. It almost immediately became obvious that the former model was wrong and the latter model accounted for all the evidence. Hence, the Watson-Crick model became rapidly accepted, replacing a vacuum rather than a previous wrong theory. My other example of an idea made possible by new measurements concerns the origins of animal electricity. Our nerve and muscle membranes operate by conducting electrical impulses arising from a change in transmembrane voltage between active and inactive membrane regions. In the absence of direct measurements of transmembrane voltage, it was impossible to propose a quantitative theory for how that voltage could change. That problem was solved between 1939 and 1952 by two developments. The anatomist J.Z. Young discovered giant nerves in squid, and physiologists developed microelectrodes small enough to insert into squid giant nerves without damaging them. Between 1945 and 1952, the physiologists Alan Hodgkin and Andrew Huxley took advantage of that anatomical discovery and that technical development to measure the electric currents moving across squid nerve as a combined function of voltage and time, and thereby to reconstruct quantitatively and in detail how a nerve impulse arises from changes in nerve membrane permeability to the positively charged ions sodium and potassium. The Hodgkin-Huxley theory was rapidly accepted because it was so convincingly correct and because it had no serious competitors. When I was a physiology student in the 1950s and 1960s, the only resistance to the theory that I recall involved some concern by non-physiologists about whether microelectrodes were causing damage to nerve membranes, a concern answered by several types of control experiments, and a non-quantitative proposal that nerve membranes and synapse or junction membranes undergo the same permeability changes. It turned out they don't. As for new ideas made possible by a new Fragestellung, consider first the foundation of the several modern sciences constituting population biology, taxonomy systematics, evolutionary biology, biogeography, ecology, animal behavior, and genetics. At least until recently, most research in all those fields except genetics involved observations, counting, and measurements requiring no equipment. Most of that research could have been done by Aristotle, Herodotus, and their contemporaries in Classical Age Greece over 2,000 years earlier. The Greeks were eminently capable of patient, accurate, quantitative observations of planets and other features of the natural world. Aristotle could similarly have examined Greek animals and plants and arrived at Linnaeus's hierarchical taxonomy. Herodotus could have compared the species of the Black Sea with those of Egypt, and thereby founded biogeography. And any ancient Greek could have grown and counted pea varieties, as did Gregor Mendel in the 1860s, noticed the differences between willow warblers and chiffchaffs, a related warbler species, as did Gilbert White in the 1780s, watched young geese, as did Conrad Lorenz in the 1930s, and thereby founded genetics, ecology, and animal behavior. But ancient Greeks lacked the necessary Fragestellung that lent interest to counting pea varieties and scrutinizing warblers and young geese. The rise of those branches of population biology from the 1700s onward was due to a modern Fragestellung that generated data, without the need for invention of microelectrodes or X-ray crystallography, which in turn generated ideas in areas where previously there had been neither data nor detailed ideas. Without going into specifics, I'll mention two other examples of important broad fields that arose only in recent centuries without any need for specialized technology, and that the ancients could have developed but didn't because they lacked a relevant Fragestellung. The Greeks and Romans were in contact with speakers of Indo-European and Semitic and other languages, could have discovered the groupings of languages in those language families, and could thereby have developed the ideas of historical linguistics. But they didn't even bother to record words of their Egyptian, Gaulish, and other subjects. In all of classical Greek and Roman literature, I'm unaware of a single word list recorded for any barbarian language, in contrast to the word lists that European travelers began routinely to gather among non-European peoples from the 1600s onward. The Greeks and Romans could equally well have noticed the observational evidence used by Freud to explore the unconscious within us, but they didn't. All of this is not to say that the view underlying this year's Edge question is always wrong. Examples in the fields in which I work myself include the replacement of biogeographic theories assuming a static Earth by the acceptance of continental drift from the 1960s onward. The rise of the taxonomic approach termed cladistics at the expense of previous taxonomic approaches, also from the 1960s onward. And the rise in the 1960s and 1970s, followed by the virtual disappearance of attempts to make use of irreversible non-equilibrium thermodynamics in the fields of population biology and cell physiology. Instead, my main point is that the development of science follows much more diverse courses than only or predominantly the course of abandoning old ideas. Max Planck's Faith. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, psychologist, co-director, Quality of Life Research Center, Claremont Graduate University, author, Flow. Note that in the introduction to this year's Edge question, Max Planck speaks of scientific truths triumphing. Truths don't triumph. The people who propose them do. What needs to be retired is the faith that what scientists say are objective truths, with a reality independent of scientific claims. Some are indeed true, but others depend on so many initial conditions that they straddle the boundary between reality and fiction. A good chess move allows a player to triumph over his opponent. Does that mean that the move is triumphant? Maybe it is in chess. We can only wish that the triumphs of science will be as innocuous.
The Illusion of Certainty. Mary Catherine Bateson, cultural anthropologist, professor emerita, George Mason University, visiting scholar, Sloan Center on Aging and Work, Boston College, Author, composing a further life. Scientists sometimes resist new ideas and hang on to old ones longer than they should. But the real problem is the public's failure to understand that the possibility of correction or disproof is a strength, not a weakness. We live in an era when it's increasingly important that the voting public be able to evaluate scientific claims and make analogies between different kinds of phenomena. But this can be a major source of error. The process by which scientific knowledge is refined is largely invisible to the public. The truth value of scientific knowledge depends on its openness to correction. Yet we all carry around ideas that science has long since revised, and we're disconcerted when asked to abandon them. Surprise! You won't necessarily drown if you go swimming after lunch. A blatant example is the role of competition in evolution, which is treated by many as a scientifically established law of nature and often taken for granted by economists and psychologists, while others argue that evolution being a theory is no more than a guess. Biology has increasingly recognized the importance of symbiosis in evolution alongside competition, as well as diversification that bypasses competition. But the survival of the fittest, a metaphor drawn by Darwin from the description of early industrial society by Herbert Spencer, survives as a binding metaphor for human behavior. Most people are uncomfortable with the notion that knowledge can be authoritative, can call for decision and action, and yet be subject to constant revision, because they tend to think of knowledge as additive, not recognizing the necessity of reconfiguring in response to new information. It is precisely this characteristic of scientific knowledge that encourages the denial of climate change and makes it so difficult to respond to what we do know in a context where much is still unknown. What kind of evidence will convince the doubters of the reality of what might best be called climate disruption? Perhaps the exploration of scientific ideas in need of retirement should be an annual event, with an emphasis on the fact that each new synthesis of complex data is potentially more inclusive. Retiring concepts that no longer fit is not primarily a matter of eliminating error, but of integrating new information and newly recognized connections into our understanding.
The Pursuit of Parsimony. Jonathan Haidt, social psychologist, professor, NYU Stern School of Business, author, The Righteous Mind. There are many things in life that are good to have, yet bad to pursue too vigorously. Money, love, and sex, for example. I'd like to add parsimony to that list. William of Ockham was a 14th-century English logician who said, "Entities must not be multiplied beyond necessity." That principle, now known as Ockham's razor, has been used for centuries by scientists and philosophers as a tool to adjudicate among competing theories. Parsimony means frugality or stinginess, and scientists should be stingy when building theories. They should use as little material as possible. If two theories do exactly as good a job of explaining the empirical evidence, then you should pick the simpler theory. If Copernicus and Ptolemy can both explain the movements of the heavens, including the occasional backward motion of some planets, then go with Copernicus's far more parsimonious model. Occam's razor is a great tool when used as originally designed. Unfortunately, many scientists have turned this simple tool into a fetish. They pursue simple explanations of complex phenomena as though parsimony were an end in itself rather than a tool to be used in the pursuit of truth. The worship of parsimony is understandable in the natural sciences, where it sometimes does happen that a single law or principle or a very simple theory explains a vast and diverse set of observations. Newton's three laws really do explain the movements of all inanimate objects. plate tectonics really does explain earthquakes, volcanoes, and the complementary coastlines of Africa and South America. Natural selection really does explain why plants, animals, and fungi look as they do. But in the social sciences, the overzealous pursuit of parsimony has been a disaster. Since the 18th century, some intellectuals have striven to do for the social world what Newton did for the physical world. Utilitarians, the French philosophes, and other utopian dreamers longed for a social order based on rational principles and a scientific understanding of human behavior. Auguste Comte, one of the founders of sociology, originally called his new discipline social physics. And what do we have to show for 250 years of pursuit? We have a series of time-wasting failures and ideological battles. Not all human behavior can be explained by positive and negative reinforcement, contra the behaviorists. Nor is it all about sex, money, class, power, self-esteem, or even self-interest, to name some of the major explanatory idols worshipped in the 20th century. In my own field, moral psychology, we have suffered from the same overzealous pursuit of parsimony. The Harvard psychologist Lawrence Kohlberg said that morality was all about justice. Others say it's about compassion. Others say morality is all about forming coalitions or preventing harm to others. But in fact, morality is complicated, pluralistic, and culturally variable. Human beings are products of evolution, so the psychological foundations of morality are innate, as I and many others have argued at Edge.org in recent years. But there are many of these foundations, and they're just the beginning of the story. You must still explain how morality develops in such variable ways, around the world and even among siblings within a single family. The social sciences are hard because human beings differ fundamentally from inanimate objects. People insist on making or finding meaning in things. They do it collectively, creating Baroque cultural landscapes that can't be explained parsimoniously. And they do it individually, creating their own unique symbolic worlds nested within their broader cultures. As the anthropologist Clifford Geertz put it, "Man is an animal suspended in webs of significance he himself has spun." This is why it's so hard to predict what any individual will do. This is why there are almost no equations in psychology or sociology. This is why there will never be a Newton in the social sciences. Let's retire the pursuit of parsimony from the social sciences. Parsimony is beautiful when we find it, but the pursuit of parsimony is sometimes an obstacle to the pursuit of truth. The Clinician's Law of Parsimony. Gerald Smallberg, practicing neurologist, New York City. Playwright, Off-Off Broadway Productions. Charter member, The Gold Ring. The law of parsimony, also known as Occam's razor, doesn't warrant a funeral, but it does have some problems in its description of reality. This law states that the most simple of two competing theories should be the preferred one, and that entities should not be multiplied needlessly. It maintains a lofty stature in philosophy and science and is often utilized as a literary device. Using the law of parsimony is the essence of good detective fiction, perhaps best achieved by Arthur Conan Doyle, a physician, who sharpened to perfection Occam's razor in the reasoning employed by his renowned creation, Sherlock Holmes. One of Holmes' most noted rules is that, when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. As an absolute, the law of parsimony is floundering. Not because it's aging poorly, but because it's increasingly challenged by the complexity of the real world. From my vantage point as a physician in the practice of clinical neurology, its usefulness, which has always been a guiding principle for me, can easily lead to blind spots and errors in judgment when rigidly followed. A case in point is that of a 79-year-old woman who complained of difficulty with her balance, with several recent falls. This could be attributed simply to age. However, there were other factors in her history that needed to be taken into account, including a diabetic neuropathy causing her feet to lose sensation, as well as compression of her cervical spinal cord, which produced weakness in her legs. She also had a hearing problem, with a long history of intermittent vertigo. Moreover, she was of Scandinavian descent, thus somewhat more prone genetically to vitamin B12 deficiency secondary to poor absorption that in her case may have been exacerbated by medications for inhibiting acid reflux. The vitamin deficiency by itself can produce neuropathy and degeneration of the spinal cord. It is in this complicated clinical setting that the law of parsimony utterly fails, and I doubt that even the great Holmes, who has the luxury of being a fictional character, could tie all these loose ends into a simple knot. To provide the appropriate care to this patient, I needed to utilize Hickam's dictum, the medical profession's counter-argument to Occam's razor. This maxim of Dr. John Hickam, who died in 1970, states very simply, "A patient can have as many diagnoses as she damn well pleases." The crucial role that the law of parsimony plays in how we reason is beyond question. This law dates back to the Greek philosophers, who refined it from their antecedents, since I suspect we evolved to seek simplicity over complexity. The desire for unity and singleness is satisfying and very seductive. However, at times it needs to be challenged by Hickam's dictum, which is a variation of the principle of plenitude. This view of reality also dates to ancient Greek philosophy, which postulates that if the universe is to be seen as perfect as possible, it must be as full as possible, in the sense that it contains as many kinds of things as it possibly could contain. Given the complexity, inconsistency, ambiguity, and ultimate uncertainty that define our reality, we shouldn't limit ourselves to using only one or the other of these valuable tools of analysis. We need to be more willing to have our positions challenged, striving to keep an open mind to other arguments, other viewpoints, and conflicting data. In order to make the best decisions for the best reasons, we must choose the appropriate heuristics, coupled with intellectual honesty, to guide our thinking as we grapple with the cunning machinations of the world we inhabit.
Essentialist Views of the Mind. Lisa Barrett, University Distinguished Professor of Psychology, Northeastern University. Research Scientist, Neuroscientist, Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School. Essentialist thinking is the belief that familiar categories, dogs and cats, space and time, emotions and thoughts, each have an underlying essence that makes them what they are. This belief is a barrier to scientific understanding and progress. In pre-Darwinian biology, for example, scholars believed that each species had an underlying essence or physical type, and variation was considered error. Darwin challenged this essentialist view, observing that a species is a conceptual category containing a population of varied individuals, not erroneous variations on one ideal individual. Even as Darwin's ideas became accepted, essentialism held fast, as biologists declared that genes are the essence of all living things, fully accounting for Darwin's variation. Nowadays, we know that gene expression is regulated by the environment, a discovery that, after much debate, prompted a paradigm shift in biology. In physics, before Einstein, scientists thought of space and time as separate physical quantities. Einstein refuted that distinction, unifying space and time and showing that they're relative to the perceiver. Even so, essentialist thinking is still seen every time an undergraduate asks, "If the universe is expanding, what is it expanding into?" In my field of psychology, essentialist thought still runs rampant. Plenty of psychologists, for example, define emotions as behaviors. For example, a rat freezes in fear or attacks in anger, each triggered automatically by its own circuit, so that the circuit for the behavior, freezing, attacking, is the circuit for the emotion, fear, anger. When other scientists showed that, in fact, rats have varied behaviors in fear-evoking situations, sometimes freezing, but other times running away or even attacking, this inconsistency was solved by redefining fear as having multiple types, each with its own essence. This technique of creating ever finer categories, each with its own biological essence, rather than abandoning essentialism, as Darwin and Einstein did, is considered scientific progress. Fortunately, other approaches to emotion have arisen, approaches that don't require essences. Psychological construction, for example, considers an emotion like fear or anger as a category with diverse instances, just as Darwin did with species. Essentialism can also be seen in studies that scan the human brain, trying to locate the brain tissue dedicated to each emotion. At first, scientists assumed that each emotion could be localized to a specific brain region. For example, fear occurs in the amygdala. But they found that each region is active for a variety of emotions. Since then, scientists, rather than abandoning essentialism, have been searching for the brain essence of each emotion in dedicated brain networks and in probabilistic patterns across the brain, always on the assumption that each emotion has an essence to be found. The fact that different brain regions and networks show increased activity during different emotions is not a problem just for emotion research. They also show increased activation during other mental activities, such as cognition and perception, and have been implicated in mental illnesses from depression to schizophrenia and autism. This lack of specificity has led to claims in news stories, blogs, and popular books, that we've learned nothing from brain imaging experiments. This seeming failure is actually a success. The data are screaming that essentialism is wrong. Individual brain regions, circuits, networks, and even neurons are not single purpose. The data point to a new model of how the brain constructs the mind. Scientists understand data through the lens of their assumptions, however. Until these assumptions change, scientific progress will be limited. Some topics in psychology have advanced beyond essentialist views. Memory, for example, was once thought to be a single process and later was split into distinct subtypes, like semantic memory and episodic memory. Memories are now thought to be constructed within the brain's functional architecture and not to reside in specific brain tissue. One hopes that other areas of psychology and neuroscience will soon follow suit. Cognition and emotion are still considered separate processes in the mind and brain, but there's growing evidence that the brain does not respect this division. That every psychological theory in which emotions and cognitions battle each other, or in which cognitions regulate emotions, is wrong. Ridding science of essentialism is easier said than done. Consider the simplicity of this essentialist statement from the past. Gene X causes cancer. It sounds plausible and takes little effort to understand. Compare this to a more recent explanation. A given individual in a given situation who interprets that situation as stressful may experience a change in his sympathetic nervous system that encourages certain genes to be expressed, making him vulnerable to cancer. The latter explanation is more complicated, but more realistic. Most natural phenomena don't have a single root cause. Sciences still steeped in essentialism need a better model of cause and effect, new experimental methods, and new statistical procedures to counter essentialist thinking. Adherence to essentialism also has serious practical impacts on national security, the legal system, the treatment of mental illness, the toxic effects of stress on physical illness. The list goes on. Essentialism leads to simplistic, single-cause thinking, whereas the world is a complex place. Research suggests that children are born essentialists. What irony! And must learn to overcome it. It's time for scientists to overcome it as well. The distinction between antisociality and mental illness. Abigail Marsh, Associate Professor of Psychology, Georgetown University. The scientific studies of mental illness and antisocial behavior continue to occupy largely separate intellectual domains. Although some patterns of persistent antisocial behavior are nominally accorded diagnostic labels, such as antisocial personality disorder or conduct disorder, the default approach to individuals who engage in persistent antisocial behavior is to view their patterns of behavior through a moral lens, as badness, rather than through a mental health lens, as madness. In some sense, this distinction represents progress. As recently as the 19th and early 20th centuries, individuals affected by all manner of psychopathologies were routinely confined and in some cases punished or even executed. Along with the emergence of understanding that symptoms of mental illness reflect disease processes, the emphasis has shifted toward prevention and treatment. However, this shift has not applied equally to all forms of psychopathology. For example, disorders primarily characterized by internalizing symptoms, persistent distress or fear, self-injuring behaviors, as opposed to externalizing symptoms, persistent anger or hostility, antisocial or aggressive behaviors, are strikingly similar in many respects. Prevalence, parallel etiologies and risk factors, and detrimental effects on social, educational, and vocational outcomes. But whereas copious scientific resources are aimed at identifying the causes and disease processes of internalizing symptoms and developing therapies for them, the emphasis on externalizing symptoms remains primarily on confinement and punishment, with relatively few resources devoted to identifying causes and disease processes or developing therapies. Comparisons of federal mental health funding, clinical trials, available therapeutic agents, and publications in biomedical journals directed toward internalizing versus externalizing symptoms all confirm this pattern. This asymmetry probably results from multiple causes, including cognitive and cultural biases that influence the decisions of scientists and policymakers, eroding support for the study of antisociality as a form of mental illness. Cognitive biases include the tendency to view actions that harm others as more intentional and blameworthy than identical actions that happen not to result in harm to others, as has been shown by the experimental philosopher Joshua Noby and others investigating the side effect effect, and to view agents who cause harm as more capable of intentional and goal-directed behavior than those who incur harm, as has been shown by the psychologist Kurt Gray and others investigating the distinction between moral agents and moral patients. These biases dictate that an individual predisposed, as a result of genetic and environmental risk factors, to behavior that harms others, will be seen as more responsible for his or her behaviors than an individual predisposed to self-destructive behavior as a result of similar risk factors. Viewing those who harm others as responsible for their actions, and thus blameworthy, may reflect evolved tendencies to reinforce social norms by blaming and punishing wrongdoers for their misbehavior. Related to these cognitive biases are cultural biases that hold self-interested behavior to be normative. Individualistic cultures view self-interest as humans' cardinal motive, superseding all other motives and underlying all human behavior. This norm may reflect the dominance of rational choice theories of human behavior favored in economics and having many adherents among scholars in other academic domains, including psychology, biology, and philosophy. Belief in the norm of self-interest is also widespread among the public, rendering behavior that isn't self-interested inherently non-normative or abnormal. This may explain why behaviors and patterns of thinking that cause oneself harm or distress are seen as irrationality and mental illness, whereas otherwise similar behaviors and patterns of thinking that cause others harm or distress are seen as rational, if immoral, choices. Indeed, if the harm to others benefits the self, such behaviors may even be seen as hyper-rational. The United States is an unusually individualistic country, which may help to explain its unusually strong adherence to the norm of self-interest, and perhaps also its unusually punitive, rather than treatment-focused, approach to crime and aggression. This approach can be contrasted with that of, for example, the relatively less individualistic Scandinavian nations, which emphasize treatment rather than punishment, even of serious criminal offenders. Mental health-focused approaches may reduce recidivism, a further indication that externalizing behaviors, including crime and aggression, may be most effectively considered symptoms of psychopathology in need of treatment, rather than simple failures of impulse control in need of punishment, and that the distinction between antisociality and mental illness should be abandoned.